From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, we'll speak with the owner of Minocqua Brewing Company, who founded a super PAC. We'll learn how he hopes it can change Wisconsin's North Woods. Then we'll remember legendary baseball player Hank Aaron, who passed away last week. Then we'll look at what it takes for aging athletes to maintain an elite level of gameplay.
The really smart aging athletes are the ones that recognize how their body feels and they understand the importance of giving it time to recover from what they just have been through.
Plus, we'll speak with the musicians behind the updated polka, I Love My Green Bay Packers.
I've been with this song for 28 years. You know, in 28 years, Jason's going to be, I'm not sure how old, but who knows? He might resurrect it back again, like long before I'm gone, you know, and the song will keep living on.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Today, we learn about Wisconsin's at-home COVID-19 testing. We remember the life of legendary baseball player Hank Aaron. We learn how football players like Aaron Rodgers managed to stay competitive late into their careers. And hear from the musicians who updated the polka known as I Love My Green Bay Packers. We'll start with this. Back in October of 2020, Minocqua Brewing Company owner Kirk Bangstad put up a big Biden-Harris sign outside of his brewery. Bangstad was threatened with fines, so he took to social media to raise awareness and support to keep the sign up. All this, and the many events of 2020, led to the Minocqua Brewing Company Super PAC. Bangstad calls it dark money for good. His ultimate goal is to help defeat Wisconsin state and federal Republican candidates in the 2022 elections and bring change to politics in Wisconsin's North Woods. To tell us more about the Super PAC, he spoke to Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski.
Now, there's a long-standing debate about keeping politics out of business, and you are the owner of Minocqua Brewing Company, and for your company, this came to a plateau with a Biden-Harris sign that you put out on the balcony of your business, nice big sign. So can you explain why you put it up and then why people in Minocqua wanted it down?
Sure. So we had to I decided to close the Minocqua Brewing Company in September because it was going to get cold. COVID cases were on the rise, and I didn't feel comfortable serving people inside of the brewing company. I was comfortable putting up a big tent out in our parking lot in the summertime, and so we had open air and air coming off of the breeze coming off of the lake to make sure that we had enough ventilation for people to eat. But I wasn't comfortable keeping the place open. And then I really thought that, you know, had Trump done anything about this in like March, you know, we could have all been wearing masks. There could have been a nationwide plan, coordinated effort to kind of tamp the virus down. We probably could have gotten, you know, way better, lower cases probably by June or July. So, you know, I felt like I needed to close my place to be safe, but I felt like it was Trump's fault, and it was all the enablers of Trump's fault that I couldn't be safe and I couldn't stay open. So that's why I decided to go full tilt for Biden and put up a Biden sign. And I said, listen, science is how breweries work. We got to use science in order to put the right yeast in, you know, in a batch of beer and have the sugars get eaten, you know, and alcohol be made. And we live and die by science, and our country has to live and die by science. And these guys weren't using science and were anti-science and anti-fact. And it just blew my mind. And so I said, I'm going full for Biden because I've been hurt by Trump and I've been hurt by the Republicans in this state. And I'm going to go for Biden, and I'm not going to be shy about it. And I also wrote recently, all small businesses, all restaurants and bars in Wisconsin who haven't had any help for the last 9 months because Mitch McConnell used this HEROES Act, the stimulus, as a political football, and hadn't passed anything until like a week ago. You know, we should all be standing up and sticking our necks out and saying this was wrong. I mean, a lot of Wisconsin bars and restaurants have gone out of business because of politics, not because we're bad business owners.
As you mentioned, small businesses, small business owners typically lean a little more conservative, yet you say that it's the small businesses that have been hurt the most during this pandemic from the lack of support. How would you characterize your business within Wisconsin's North Woods and characterize the North Woods itself for people who aren't familiar?
My business in the North Woods, I mean, we were a pretty, it's all tourism up here. You know, people come to get away from the heat. They come to enjoy, you know, snowmobiling and boating and water skiing, you know, in the summertime, and fishing and hiking. And so typically we're a really popular North Woods tourist destination because we make our own beer and, you know, and we're a pretty big space. So we could fit a lot of people in there all summer long. And most of the businesses are like that. And the North Woods in general is probably now, in the last 10 years, one of the most conservative and kind of red areas in the state of Wisconsin. So anybody just trying to run a good business, it's got to think twice before, you know, being too liberal and too progressive in the North Woods of Wisconsin, I would imagine.
Right. So let's talk about what led you to go a step further than just putting up lots of Biden-Harris signs in a conservative part of the state. So out of the April primary and the recent sign endeavors having to close your business due to the coronavirus, you know, out of all this, you decided the best way to make change was to form a super PAC. So how much did you know about these and what did you end up diving into researching them?
I would have never thought about a super PAC up here outside of it. This is, you know, goes back to a question you asked me earlier. The county, Oneida County, when I put up my Biden sign, they sent me a letter saying I had to remove that sign because it was too big. It was more than 32 square feet. I immediately called a First Amendment lawyer and we realized that they couldn't regulate the size of a political sign because there was a Supreme Court decision in 2015 that said that wasn't legal. So we knew we were right, but I was able to post something on Facebook and say, listen, if these guys try to fine us and it could be $250 a day, and it was, we put it up in October, so it was a month before the election, you know, it could be like $8,500. And so let's raise $8,500. Now, here's the link to buy a t-shirt with some of our beer logos. And hopefully we can raise $8,500 and pay our fines because I'm certainly not taking down this Biden sign. So I sold over $100,000 worth of t-shirts in 4 days from people all over the United States. So I was like, something's going on here in northern Wisconsin because of what I just posted. And I'm like, you know, this is giving me hope that maybe we can actually make the North Woods of Wisconsin a more progressive place with just a little attention, political attention. I think the Democratic Party in Wisconsin has kind of washed their hands of this area because we're so red and there's not a lot of strong, you know, party stuff going on up here. I mean, the parties are small and mighty, but we're still pretty small. So, you know, I just thought let's just keep going with this momentum. You know, people love the story. It got, you know, got aired on the New York Times, the Washington Post, and it's like, let's keep on going with this. And we actually might be able to make a change up here and, you know, make politics a little cleaner and a little less corrupt in the North Woods.
Right. So on the note of making it cleaner, less corrupt, super PACs are often associated with words like dark money or corporations influencing politics. So how do you plan... How do you plan to educate people on what your super PAC is and draw support?
Yeah, well, that's the great thing about it. Like, I was like, I hated super PACs, you know? Like, these guys, it's like the Koch brothers, like, infiltrating, you know, these rural areas, and nobody knows where this money's coming from. And part of what I think America is in such a dark place right now is because of dark money. But I was like, I'm a corporation, you know, I just so happen Monaco Brewing Company is a corporation. So why can't I start a super PAC just like the Koch brothers did? And so I call it, in quotes, like dark money for good. So, you know, no matter what, I mean, as a corporation, I can't donate money politically unless I form a super PAC. I can't give money to the Democratic Party as a corporation. Personally, I can. So, you know, the only way for me to say I'm donating 5% of all of my profits to politics, I had to form a super PAC legally to do that. So that's the reason I formed it. But now, I mean, I'm going to write a newsletter every week. I'm going to say how much money we raised. I'm going to be completely transparent about this because I think that that's what people expect, you know, from somebody who's not corrupt and wants to just get the Northwoods more progressive. So I'm going to write a newsletter and say what we've raised, and I'm going to, you know, say what we've spent the money on. And hopefully the goal is to just remind people for the next 2 years that Tom Tiffany and Ron Johnson, you know, perpetuated the lie that caused this insurrection that made us all completely ashamed of our country last week.
So you mentioned being transparent about how much you're raising, what these funds will go to. Have you made a general plan about how you plan to allocate this money between now and then come high time in 2022 elections?
No, I have no general plan yet. I mean, we raised $25,000. And I think the last, when you called me up and asked me if I wanted to be on the show like a week ago, I was like, I think it was like 10 or 15. Like now it's 25,000 in about a week. And initially, you know, my thoughts were, this is, what did super PACs do? They put up ads during elections, generally negative ads, to sway people's mind, to get people to, you know, vote a certain way. So that was kind of all I had in my thoughts in the beginning. But now I've had about 15 or 20 people email me saying they wanted to volunteer. They wanted to help organize. They wanted to change people's minds up in the North Woods. So now I'm like, well, maybe there's a cleaner way to do this other than to buy a bunch of negative ads, you know, in 2 years. Maybe we can hire some sort of a really smart organizer, you know, and get people to kind of work the neighborhoods for the next 2 years. Kind of like, you know, Stacey Abrams seemingly did. She worked the neighborhoods in Georgia. And crazily, we got two Democratic U.S. senators out of that. So I was motivated by what I saw in Georgia to potentially do this a cleaner way, you know, instead of just spending money on negative ads, which, you know, irritates everybody.
Obviously, there's support, not just financially in what you've seen so far. Does this give you hope when you're living in a mostly conservative place, being someone who's on the other side of the spectrum? How do you balance that personally?
Well, I balance it knowing that this area for upwards of 20 to 30 years was represented by David Obey, who was a pretty liberal Democrat. I'm also further buoyed knowing that Wisconsin in general has voted more, you know, there's more Democrats that are voting than Republicans in the state. However, districts have been gerrymandered so badly that we don't see that reflected in the makeup of our state legislatures. So I don't think the North Woods is a lost cause. And I think that we might be able to do something if we have honest conversations with people, that people will maybe start listening to facts again up here. And maybe we can all kind of use the same set of facts to make decisions about what's right and wrong. Because I don't think the people that vote for Trump up here are bad people. I think they've been misled, horribly misled. And so hopefully we can have fact-based conversations up here over the next 2 years that, you know, make people, make good American Northern Wisconsinites vote for fairness and vote for good government and clean government and stop being so Republican or Democrat, even though people think I'm the most partisan guy in the world. Ultimately, all I want is fair and clean government.
Kirk Bengstad is the owner of Minocqua Brewing Company, which formed a super PAC earlier this month. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski, and you can listen to their full conversation at WUWM.com. The COVID-19 pandemic is still raging around the nation. So far, more than 400,000 Americans have died from this disease. And health professionals are urging people to continue taking precautions like wearing masks, maintaining a physical distance from other people, and getting tested if you have symptoms. Now in Wisconsin, you don't even need to leave your home to learn if you've been infected. The Wisconsin Department of Health Services is giving people free at-home tests. To learn more about these tests, I'm joined by Tracy DeSalvo, the acting director of the Bureau of Communicable Diseases at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Tracy, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
Let's say I'm someone who wants to get one of these at-home tests. How do I do that?
That's a great question, Joy. And it's a really easy process. What you can do is go online to our DHS website at dhs.wisconsin.gov. And if you visit the COVID-19 page and click on Getting Tested, we have all of the information right there for you. You can click on a link to get sent to the page to order an at-home test from Vault, and it'll be sent directly to your house in just a couple of days.
So when I get this at-home test, what will be included inside of it?
The at-home test is going to include all the supplies that you need to take the test. It's a PCR test, and it is done using saliva rather than a swab. So it's going to come with some instructions and a collection tube for that saliva or spit. And it's also going to come with some information to help you connect to a provider from Vault via Zoom. And they actually will have you do that test via Zoom, and they'll walk you through the steps, and you'll have a provider there to help you along the way.
Interesting. So is there anything, you know, you get the test, you've taken it out. Are there any common errors that people should try to avoid? Let's say, you know, I'm a person who has a number of pets in my home. Is there a concern about contamination through a variety of things?
Certainly you would want to, you know, keep that tube sealed until you were ready to do the collection and you were on the call with your provider, and you want to seal that tube that you've collected your specimen in right away and follow the appropriate instructions that they're going to give you when you're talking to that provider for sealing it up and sending it in. But other than that, you know, nothing particular, especially related to pets or others. One thing that I would note is that you do just want to make sure that you're really clearly following any instructions related to eating or drinking that they're going to give you beforehand. There's going to be perhaps some time ahead of time that they don't want you to eat or drink before you do that specimen collection.
Okay. So a healthcare provider will walk you through the steps as you're doing it. But after you've taken the test, what do you do next?
Sure. You're going to package up that specimen, and these kits have to be sent back with UPS. So you can go to a UPS drop box or other UPS drop site and send it in. And it's going to get to the lab and be tested really quickly. We have about a 2-day turnaround time at the moment. And that's from when your specimen is collected and sent until you have a result from the lab. The great piece about this is that those test results are going to come to you directly via your email address. An important piece there is that everyone in a family who is going to have a test done needs to have a separate email address so that individuals can get the appropriate lab results.
Why should someone choose at-home testing versus going to one of these community testing sites? What are the benefits, and what are some of the downsides?
Sure. Some of the benefits certainly is that it's available to anyone. You won't have to leave your house other than maybe to drop that off at a UPS drop site. So you can get your specimen mailed in. A nice convenient feature of this is that you could perhaps order it ahead of time and have it in your medicine cabinet and ready to go. So I could order it today. And then if you have symptoms down the line, you would have that available as you need it. So it's convenience, of course. And for some people, you know, going to that community testing site would be their first choice. And certainly that option is available as well. But it's really just about giving people options so that we can make sure people have access to testing that fits them and their needs. And it's available and accessible around the state. I will say there's one caveat there, is that it's for kids 4 and above. So it's almost everyone in the state who's eligible for this, but certainly anyone in the state who's over 4 years old could order one of these tests.
Now, you mentioned it's about a 2-day turnaround. Something that we've talked about a lot is this idea of rapid testing. That doesn't exactly sound rapid. Is there a reason that you might want to get results more quickly?
Sure. There are two different types of tests that are being used to test for COVID-19. And the kind that's referred to as a rapid test is an antigen test. And those do have really rapid turnaround and can often be done on site. This is actually a PCR test, which is considered the gold standard of testing. And so the PCR process does usually usually take a little bit longer. You know, 24 to 48 hours is the average turnaround, just depending on what lab you're using for that testing. And because you do have a shipping step here, it's about 2 days turnaround, but that's really still a very good turnaround time for a PCR test. There are also places where that antigen test is being used, where it's important to have more rapid results. Those are also being used for a lot of screening programs. So certainly both tests have great utility, and we're glad to see both tests being available and being used in Wisconsin.
Do we see this at-home test as part of a larger push to start winding down some of the in-person testing we've seen throughout the state, or is this just in addition to that?
This is really in addition to the other testing options that are available in the state of Wisconsin. Of course, going to your provider is one way to get a test, those community testing sites. And this is really just an additional tool in the toolbox to provide people another option for getting tested in Wisconsin. I think an important thing that we always want to remind people is that if you have any symptoms of COVID-19, certainly we want you to get a test. If you have a known exposure to COVID-19, we want you to get a test. Getting tested is a really important way that we can identify cases, and that can help to initiate contact tracing and other follow-up so we can reduce the spread of COVID-19 in the state. So please, if you have symptoms, if you have a known exposure, there's lots of ways in Wisconsin to get a test, and we really encourage everyone to do so.
All right. Well, Tracy, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thanks for having me.
Tracy DeSalvo is the acting director of the Bureau of Communicable Diseases at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. If you've ever wondered how aging athletes can maintain an elite level of gameplay, you'll want to stick around. Coming up in about 10 minutes, the head team physician for the Bucks and the Brewers joins us with some insight on how a player like Aaron Rodgers has maintained his ability late into his career. But first, we'll listen back to an interview about legendary baseball player Hank Aaron and look back at his early career playing in the minor leagues in Eau Claire.
Here's a young man who basically has to learn whether he has the fortitude to fight through and say, okay, I'm strong enough to live in a white city, play in a white team, be away from home, make it on my own. And that's what he did that summer.
That's coming up on Lake Effect here on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Legendary baseball player Hank Aaron passed away last week at the age of 86. Also known as Hammerin' Hank, Aaron started his career playing for the Milwaukee Braves and continued to play for the team when they moved to Atlanta. That's where Aaron broke Babe Ruth's home run record and earned himself the title of Home Run King. Aaron was also a beacon for racial tolerance. He began his career in the minor leagues in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, where he faced challenges as one of the few people of color living and working in the city. Jerry Poling wrote a book about Aaron's early life, and he spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke about it back in 2009.
All kinds of little things are going on back then, I think, that made it difficult, where it still wasn't really a fair system for the black player, not only, you know, professionally, but I think socially, just still a difficult time in any of these cities, especially when you look at, you know, Hank Aaron. I mean, he was not the first black player to play in Eau Claire. The first one was Billy Bruton in 1950, another player who went on to play for the Milwaukee Braves. So in a sense, the color barrier had been broken in Eau Claire, but there still was that awkwardness between blacks and whites in Eau Claire that Hank had to deal with, and not only from a social interaction standpoint, but really part of his own, on a personal level, he had to get used to playing in a white city and on a white team for the first time. So it wasn't just whites getting used to blacks, it was vice versa in a lot of these cities. It was the black players, you know, having to, you know, find their own way in a city like Eau Claire that was 99.9% white.
Well, and you describe it as awkwardness, which is a significant difference than what the situation was like in the South, though. Was there, were there scenes of ugliness, or was it primarily just a sense for how unusual it was to see a black face in an overwhelmingly white place?
That's the sense I got from Aaron and a couple of other black players when they described what it was like playing Eau Claire, is that it wasn't really racism or racial epithets being, you know, shouted at them during games, or, you know, there might have been the occasional refusal of service at a restaurant or hotel, or implication that it might be there. But it wasn't really that, you know, in terms of the way it was in the South. It was more sort of this awkward social period where the black players in Eau Claire were essentially the only black people in town. There might have been a couple others. And the white people knew they were the players, and there was some staring going on that Aaron talked about in his book, I Had a Hammer. He said it was just, you know, it was uncomfortable for him. He was sort of like a in a fishbowl, and everybody stared at him. And Wes Covington was, Aaron Wes Covington and Julius Bowers were the three black players on the 1952 team in Eau Claire. And there was sort of a sense that they, you know, they were the black guys in town, and they had to deal with people staring at them and kind of looking at them a little differently. But it wasn't really a sense that they were being treated poorly in any way at all.
What about on the field? I mean, the North was a different place for blacks to play in those days, but on the other hand, Hank Aaron was from Alabama, and plenty of other players in the Northern League were, I imagine, from the South. Were there issues of racial dynamics on the field itself?
No, I never came across any of that. You know, that in talking to Aaron and doing the research for my book, that he had any problems with other players or coaches in the Northern League. He always said he was treated fairly by the manager in Eau Claire. And interestingly enough, the manager in Eau Claire that year, Bill Adair, in 1952, was from Mobile, Alabama, Hank Aaron's hometown. And Aaron, at first, when he heard that, he was concerned that having a white manager from Mobile, that he might be treated the way other blacks were treated in Mobile. But that wasn't the case. Bill Adair was a very fair man and treated the ballplayers all alike, Aaron said. And I really think on the field, he had a very fair shake in terms of the organization and his teammates. You know, I don't remember hearing any stories of teammates not treating him like any other teammate, which, unlike Jackie Robinson, you know, we saw some of that. I mean, his own teammates and other opposing players weren't always the most gracious to him.
Were there other impacts that the one summer in Eau Claire had on Hank Aaron that extended off the baseball field? I know, for example, you're right that one of the lessons it taught him was about dealing with loneliness as a player, especially as he chased Babe Ruth.
I think so, yeah. You know, in my opinion, the summer Hank Aaron had in Eau Claire was really set him up for the rest of his life in terms of how he handled himself. You know, he learned so many lessons in Eau Claire, and one of them was, you know, how to handle loneliness and being in the spotlight and being away from home and just relying on himself. He really grew up as a person that summer because, you know, when he had left home in February of that year, he was 17, or had just turned 18, I believe, and really pretty much a kid, and he'd never been away from home and never been away from his mom's cooking, any of that, and all of a sudden he's on the road for months at a time. So now here's a young man who basically has to learn whether he has the fortitude to fight through all that and say, okay, I'm strong enough to live in a white city, play in a white team, be away from home, 1,200, 1,500 miles away from home, make it on my own. And that's what he did that summer. He needed self-reliance to make it through that, but he also had to make it through in a place where he felt awkward and really even maybe a little scared at times, being in a white city and having never been in that environment before. So he really went through a kind of a trial by fire, in a sense, in his own mind, of just being able to say, can I handle this? Can I do it? And I think by the middle of the summer, you know, personally, he kind of passed that test. He felt like he could handle it. There was a point early in the summer where he had injured another player accidentally on an opposing team, and actually, it was I was kind of scared at that point of just being away from home and really homesick, and thought about coming home, and had actually called home and said he was going to quit. And his family told him that this was his shot, and he, you know, really should just stick with it. And he did. And so really the challenge for him was to just overcome all those fears and realize he was a strong enough person to survive that situation. And then as he went forward in his life, I think that was the foundation for him to say, if I can handle that when I'm 17 years old in Eau Claire, being that far away from home and in a totally awkward environment, you know, I can handle these other things as I go forward in my life.
I gather people in Eau Claire think of that summer in a positive light as well, what it spoke about the city.
I think so. I think people in Eau Claire are very proud. You know, there's a statue of Henry at the stadium in Eau Claire, which still has a summer college team that plays here in the Northwoods League. And it's really a source of pride, I think, for the city to think they, you know, they gave Henry a fair shake and treated him, you know, fairly, and they got one of an American icon on the road to success. And people in Eau Claire, I think, are very proud of that, that they, you know, they didn't shun him or treat him poorly. You know, they just treated him like another resident of Eau Claire in 1952. It's something here, I think, that people are very proud of, that we were good to him. And he's always said that, you know, that's where he got his start. And without having a good summer in Eau Claire, he said, you know, he said he didn't know what would have happened to him in his career. Because there were a lot of players in Henry's situation who were coming to the minor league teams in the Northern League, all around the Northern League at that time, who maybe didn't have the strength that Henry had, and they went through difficult times like Henry, and they did go home. There were a lot of blacks who, it was too difficult, and they didn't survive what Henry did. I think he was good enough on the field and strong enough, had a solid family background, and his parents and the family were behind him. I think he had everything he really needed to just push through all that and get to the majors, and then once he got there, everybody knows he was, you know, a superstar within a couple of years.
Jerry Pauling is the author of A Summer Up North, Henry Aaron, and The Legend of Eau Claire Baseball. He spoke to Lake Effect's Mitch Teich about it as part of a Project Milwaukee series in 2009. Coming up later in the show, we'll learn how the fan favorite polka, I Love My Green Bay Packers, got an update.
The song is kind of like bread and butter. Everybody can attach to it and enjoys it, and that's why it doesn't get old. I think the lyrics we kept fresh, but the song itself has always been fresh.
But first, the head team physician for the Bucks and the Brewers joins us to explain how Aaron Rodgers had such a successful season at this point in his career. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. This season was exciting for Packers fans. The team wasn't just the first seed in the NFC. Quarterback Aaron Rodgers could also be on his way to winning MVP for the third time in his career. Although Rodgers is just 37 years old, that places him among the oldest players in the NFL. Yet he continues to be competitive against players nearly half his age. So how does he do it? Dr. Bill Rosch has some ideas. Dr. Rosch is a team physician for the Milwaukee Bucks, as well as the Brewers, and he's the head of sports medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He joins me now. Dr. Rosch, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Glad to be here.
What are some of the biggest concerns that really any professional sports player has as they begin to age?
Well, unfortunately, even athletes can't escape time. As we age, tissues become a little bit more brittle and recovery takes a little bit longer. And so I think athletes realize that if they don't maintain their condition to the best they can, they're more likely to be injured. And when it comes to injury, really, there's only so many things you can do to prevent injury. Luck plays a role. You can do everything correct. And especially in football, you're struck on the side of a knee by a player you never even saw, and you've got a bad knee injury. Genetics play a part. There are, without question, some individuals that, for all practical purposes, have tougher tissue. They take trauma, injury, energy to their body better than others. And so that plays a role. And then, of course, there's the conditioning. Bottom line is if you're strong, you can support the joints better, fight off sort of stresses that occur during the game. And then you also want to be flexible as well. So a loose, flexible athlete can absorb energy better, is less likely to tear things. And so we look at those two things. With regards to the aging athlete, like I said, recovery, I think, is very important for them because they don't recover as quickly. Your body takes more time, and recognizing the time you need to recover is important. You know, when it comes to, for instance, baseball pitchers, you know, taking care of the Brewers, a lot of times the older pitchers are very in tune with their bodies, and they'll realize that if they had a difficult outing and threw a lot of pitches, that they may not in 2 days do their typical bullpen preparations for the next start, but rather realize, you know, I need to take a little bit more time off. My body isn't quite there. So I think the really smart aging athletes are the ones that recognize how their body feels, and they understand the importance of giving it time to recover from what they just have been through.
You mentioned some of the concerns that a pitcher might have, and a bit about, you know, just the injuries that you sustain in football. When we're looking at a quarterback like Aaron Rodgers, what are some of the unique concerns that we have with this position?
Well, football is kind of unique among the sports in that anything can happen. Let's face it. You've got large athletic individuals colliding at high rates of speed. You know, when you think about baseball, you think about shoulders and elbows, and those are pretty predictable injuries that occur often because of the unique activities they're doing. When you talk about basketball, you talk about like the Bucks, you talk about knees, jumping, you see a lot of articular wear. Basically, they wear things out faster than most because they basically push a lifetime of activity into a relatively short career. With football, the injuries they actually do vary by position. Quarterbacks, obviously, any type of collision, you can break an ankle, you can damage a knee, you can dislocate a hip, you can dislocate a shoulder. With quarterbacks, because they have to throw, we do worry more about shoulder injuries. Interesting enough, when you look at motion analysis, motion capture to assess the stresses on the shoulder, the football throwing motion is much less stressful on a shoulder than a baseball pitcher. Even though the football weighs more than a baseball, the velocities are different. At the same time, however, you can, with repetitive throwing, fatigue the rotator cuff, and with the cuff fatigue, then you can injure the labrum, which is this sort of bumper inside the socket that kind of holds things and gives information on how to control the shoulder. Shoulder dislocations, falling on the shoulder, the clavicle, you know, the AC joint where the collarbone meets the shoulder blade. That's a common injury that occurs when players are tackled, they land on their shoulder and they dislocate that joint. Typically, that can be a very painful injury. Fortunately, it's typically not too serious an injury and typically heals well without surgery.
Hmm. You know, of course, we're not really talking about old men. We're talking about relatively young men. Aaron Rodgers is, you know, only 37, but he's playing against much younger men. When you're in, you know, your mid to late 30s, your early 40s, how can you evolve your style of gameplay to not only keep up with these younger guys, but in some ways dominate them?
You know, I think the players that really last the longest have a level of intelligence that allows them to do that. They recognize what risk they're taking with every single play. You know, a younger player might assume they can do something they really can't get away with, and then they get hit hard, but fortunately they can tolerate that stress, that load, that impact. I think the smarter, older players that stay around realize when to throw the ball away, when not to take a hit, when to fall to the ground, and to protect themselves and their body. You know, but at the same time, you have extremely competitive individuals. And I think it's always a balance between that they have to sort of quench that competitive desire where they're not going to give up. They're going to do everything they can to win the game. At the same time, I think common sense does take over at some point, and they recognize when the risk is just simply too great, and they're not going to put their body into that position where they can do significant damage.
When we're looking at specifically Aaron Rodgers and his style of gameplay, is there anything that has allowed him to continue to play at this really elite level that's significantly different than what we've seen with other aging players?
Oh, I think it's his intelligence. I mean, I think he's able to see what the defense is doing. He's able to anticipate the risk to himself and to his teammates when he distributes the ball. You combine that with, you know, he has such a quick release where, you know, other players, if they're going to throw the ball, they've got to sort of wind up a little bit. Every millisecond counts, you know, getting rid of the ball before you're hit, where Aaron Rodgers has that ability to flick the ball, you know, 40 yards down the field without effort, it seems. But you have an extremely intelligent individual, and then you have an individual who has the ability to release the ball so quickly so he can get out of trouble relatively quickly. And he's mobile too. He still has his legs beneath him. He doesn't scramble, I think, as much as he has had before. And again, perhaps that's the intelligence taking over, I would assume. But no, I think it's the intelligence combined with his unique athletic ability to release the ball quickly.
I think there have been a lot of questions about Aaron Rodgers' future in general. You know, there was this player who was drafted before the season began that people were going, oh, are they looking at replacements for Aaron Rodgers? As you see him on the field in these playoff games, does it seem like this is a player who's winding down, or do you see a player who still has some time ahead of him?
You know, as a fan of the Green Bay Packers, I'd like to think that he has many years ahead of him. You know, like right now he's sort of the odds-on favorite, as I understand it, to be the MVP. So anytime you can be the MVP, it typically implies, I mean, just common sense dictates that, yeah, he can play a few more years. Ultimately, it's up to that player. Again, what benefits him so much is that he's just a smart guy. He understands what's going on. He sees the plays. He's able to recognize, you know, what I think he can recognize when he's putting himself in danger and when he's not, to a better degree than some other players. And so with unique ability and with a lot of smarts, typically you can significantly reduce that risk of injury. And so I take care of a lot of, you know, players at the end of their career. And the really good players recognize that they're not as good sometimes. There's certain things they can't do the same way. But that's okay because they figure out other ways of doing it. If you have, for instance, a pitcher that used to throw fastballs in the high 90s, but now he tops out at, let's say, 92 instead of 98, well, he can't strike out guys as easily as before without that extremely fast pitch. But what does he do? He learns how to vary the speed. He learns how to add additional pitches to keep the batter off balance so that all of a sudden that 92-mile-per-hour fastball seems like it's 98 because he just threw him something in the 70s, the pitch before. So, again, as you lose, and we all do, there's no question about it. As we age, we lose speed, we lose strength. That's just the natural aging process. We take longer to recover. Our tissues become more brittle. But if you can use your intelligence and learn how to, and recognize, I think you also have to recognize those limitations, that creates the successful individual that can continue to play, you know, as long as they really have that competitive desire to do so.
Well, hopefully he doesn't pack up and take those smarts to jeopardy long term. But
yeah.
Dr. Rosh, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
My pleasure. You take care.
Dr. Bill Rosh is the head of sports medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and he's a lead team physician for the Milwaukee Bucks, Milwaukee Brewers, and Milwaukee Ballet.
Go Pack, go!
Eddie J. Lemberger wrote and released I Love My Green Bay Packers back in 1993. Since then, it's become an unofficial fan favorite theme song for the team. Now the polka is bringing in new fans with an update that still celebrates the green and gold. Lemberger collaborated with musician Jason Fabus and his band West Coast Prost to create the new version of this classic song. They both joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski, and Lemberger starts by explaining how the song first came together.
When I first wrote the song in 1993, that was the first title I had. And then I thought, you know, this would be more powerful if I used, instead of the Green Bay Packers, my Green Bay Packers, because, of course, our Green Bay Packers are our team. You know, it's the greatest tradition in professional sports. And, you know, to have a professional team from a small city like Green Bay in a state like Wisconsin and have the great tradition that we have, it's something quite amazing. So, and we can all claim the Packers as our team. They're our team. And we love them. And I think Jason mentioned one time it's a tradition, it's a movement, the Green Bay Packers and our Green Bay Packers, yeah.
Jason, you're from Milwaukee, you're currently living in LA, but obviously still a Packer fan out there. What kind of role has this song played in your world, and why did you want to team up to give it a little revamp here?
I first heard the song in the 96-97 season, which was when I was probably 8 years old. And was a diehard Packer fan, and the team was doing very well that year, and this song kind of was a theme song for the team. Everybody rallied behind it. It was played on all the radio stations in Milwaukee where I was growing up, and I still remember it to this day. And for years now, as I've been getting older, I've been thinking I would like to, you know, do it again. I'd like to get in touch with Ed, and it's time to bring it back. And this year just really seemed to be the right time.
So you reached out to Ed and initiated this project?
Yeah, I used a really high technology way of getting in touch with him called Facebook.
Yes.
Yeah, I reached out to Ed on Messenger and gave him the idea, and I'm really glad that he took the message and received it well.
Yeah, Ed, what were you thinking? Were you like toying with the idea of on and off, or was this like a good springboard for you to be like, yeah, I guess it's time to do this again?
Well, I had thought about re-releasing I Love My Green Bay Packers for years. And Jason is such a great musician, and his band is so good. And I think this whole project, I think the song is in better shape than it's ever been. And that's thanks to Jason and his band. Very happy with the way everything happened. And it happened organically, kind of the same way that the I Love My Green Bay Packers song became a hit back in 1996. You know, it was, I didn't even know all these radio and TV stations had the song, but things were happening to me synchronistically at the time.
No, I think it's very important that we talk about how you cranked up the polka. You know, Jason, despite as a jazz musician being your main form of what you're doing musically nowadays, living in LA, it certainly shows that you haven't forgotten how to polka.
Yeah, the polka band has been with me everywhere I go. We had one in Minnesota when I went to college there. I think that band is still playing out there. And then as I moved out to Los Angeles, I wanted to start a band out here. And it's a big part of Milwaukee tradition. And just like being a Packer fan is a big part of Wisconsin tradition, so is polka music. So we do it out here, and we do it on the West Coast. And there's a lot of people out here who may have never heard it before. So we're happy to bring it out here.
Your band is called West Coast Prost. And with a band like that, you'd assume your bandmates are maybe Midwesterners or and Packer fans. But did you have to convince any of them to don the green and gold and get into the project?
I did. When we were putting this together, we had to turn this whole project around in about 4 days, I think, Ed, right?
Yeah, something like that by the time we acted on it, yeah.
We got it done quickly, and I remember one day I was driving all around Los Angeles to each band member and dropping off Packers gear that I had. I had enough t-shirts and hats for everybody. We had to locate a cheesehead from another fan, so we got it done.
I also love how some of your band members are balancing playing their instruments and also a big old stein of beer and taking, you know, sips of beer in between their measures and breaks.
Yeah, that's pretty typical in a polka band. Sometimes you got to tell the guys it's their turn to play and they're still over there drinking beer. But, you know, we pulled it together for the video.
You know, it shows Wisconsin, too. So when you were both working on the revision of this song, what lyrics or components were easy to decide to keep in as essential, and what sections did you feel needed a little updating?
Well, I think the second verse has all the names, you know, dropped names of different celebrities to tell them that we love our group, that I love my Green Bay Packers, or we love our Green Bay Packers. And so we just updated all those. We went from Rush Limbaugh, tell that Rush Limbaugh tale, Hillary and Bill, and Oprah and Phil. We changed those to Kelly and Ryan and Meghan and Harry and Beyonce and Gaga, Miley C, things like that. We updated it. And then we went also with the Kardashians.
Yo, Eddie J, you know, we got Packers fans all over this great nation.
Hey, Jason, that's why our country is Packer Country USA.
Tell Kelly and Ryan, Beyonce, Ellen D.
Tell them what?
I love my Green Bay Packers. Tell Meghan and Harry. Tell Gaga, Miley C.
And Bezos too.
I love my Green Bay Packers. I'll bet them Kardashians are secret Packer fans.
They look so dumb.
They know the best shellackers. So if you're green with envy, wear gold that perfect matches. That's why I love my Green Bay Packers.
You know, I mean, Kim and I, we share the same DNA, you know. Her father was Armenian and my mother Armenian. So, and then my father was European. So I thought we got to, you know, get some Armenian blood into this thing, even though I've got a Lemberger as a German last name. My father was German. So good old Kardashian Armenians.
Absolutely. So when you first wrote this original version in 1993, Eddie, how do you feel working on it again, reflecting on this song and going around touring with the Packers tailgate group and now reintroducing it in a new way to everyone and also, of course, virtually?
I think now I Love My Green Bay Packers is, you know, the premier sort of theme song, you know, unofficial theme song for the Green Bay Packers. And probably like I've been with this song for 28 years, you know, in 28 years, Jason's going to be, I'm not sure how old, but who knows? He might resurrect it back again, like long before I'm gone, you know, and the song will keep living on.
We are going to have to probably discuss doing a collaboration with Lil Wayne after he just released his Packers song as well. So,
okay, that would be great.
We'll wait for his call.
Yeah, we'll make him do some polka.
I told Lil Wayne on Twitter, and I'm sure that he never saw this, but I said, I like the new song, but it could use more tuba.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
All these things you're mentioning are quintessential sounds of the Midwest that we're all used to. What do you think it is about this song that keeps it in such a special place?
I would say the lyrics are super catchy. The melody is very sweet. I was telling Ed Lemberger that the song is kind of like bread and butter. Everybody can attach to it and enjoys it, and that's why it doesn't get old. I think the lyrics we kept fresh, but the song itself has always been fresh. And polka music in general is just, it's joyous music. It's happy music. You cannot help but feel happy when you listen to it, no matter where you come from or what culture you're from. So, you know, the accordion and the tuba are beloved instruments in our music.
And also in our Packer circles. So Jason and Eddie, I want to thank you both so much for joining me to talk about I Love My Green Bay Packers and Go Pack Go.
Go Pack Go.
Yeah. Thank you, Audrey.
Yes, we take our opposition and crunch them like they're crackers. That's why I love my Green Bay Packers. We got the best team. Go Pack!
Eddie J. Lemberger and Jason Fabus are the songwriters and musicians behind the updated re-release of I Love My Green Bay Packers. They joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski, and you can see the music video for the polka at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn what may be causing us to have such a mild winter and what we can expect for future winters in Wisconsin. We'll also look at a new report on people pursuing STEM careers and the gender and racial disparities in that field. That's tomorrow at 10 on Lake Effect, here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.